Thanks for having me here. I'm going to talk about the gravitational field of a massless particle on the horizon of a rotating black hole. And this is work I did with my collaborator in Santa Barbara over the last year, year and a half or so, Joe Swearingen. And for the most part, this will be a talk only about classical gravity, but it is motivated by quantum field theory and the black hole information problem. So I want to spend just a few minutes at the beginning focusing on the particular corner of that literature that I want to keep in the back of my mind during the talk. And then I will get right to reviewing the original curved space shockwave solution by Dreyen et Hooft, which is the curved space generalization of the Eichelberg-Sechsel wave. And the goal will be to generalize it to rotating black holes. And before doing this, I spent a good amount of time thinking about a suitable formalism that would point the way forward rather than just proceeding, trying to generalize the coordinates and so forth. And so I want to spend a lot of time discussing and going through the spin coefficient formalism as originally introduced by Newman and Penrose in the 60s and then updated by Garoche, Held, and Penrose in the 70s. And that coupled with recasting or recognizing the shockwave solution as an example of the Kerr-Shield metrics, we can see very general properties will emerge, and that will immediately point the way towards generalizing the result. And from step 3 to step 4 is a lot of algebra, and I will just show you the results. So if you want to go back to the original Hawking paper on evaporation and summarize the assumptions that went into it, they're very basic, and they can be summarized as classical gravity coupled to quantum matter fields is a reasonable computational framework. And I think one way to summarize the AMPS paper and the firewall paper and the subsequent literature is that maybe that's not quite right. Because we will see that as soon as you turn on gravitational back reaction, the field theory is not what you thought it was. And what I mean by that is to go back to an old paper by Kim, Verlinde, and Verlinde from 95 and consider the propagation of a scalar field on a classical black hole background. As you know, as a standard, near the horizon, the equation of motion for the scalar field, which is the ordinary Klein-Gordon equation, reduces approximately to the ordinary wave equation in Eddington UV coordinates. And that equation of motion can be solved by the unconstrained variables or unconstrained functions of U and V separately, as we know. And this means that in this limit, they commute. What these authors pointed out is that as soon as you turn on gravitational back reaction, and you think about, for example, the outgoing component of the field as being a background field and the ingoing fluctuations across it, or vice versa, the commutation between the fields is non-zero. And in fact, this relation can be exponentiated, and what you find is that phi in and phi out are not mutually local objects. They serve as translational defect lines for each other, and this is encapsulated in this lower order formula here. And you can read these quotes from the paper, but all I want to point out is that A, the commutator is non-zero, it evolves exponentially in time, and all of the symbols in this expression are standard except for this profile F. When I use X and X prime with vector arrows, it just means points on the two-sphere, so points on the bifurcation surface of the spacetime. And this profile is the transverse profile of what I will call the gravitational shockwave. So reasoning closely related to this is what led Alexei Kitaev to invent the SYK model. And you know, lots of people have considered this since. And so motivated by this, I'm just going to step back, go to the classical gravity picture, and review what is the gravitational shockwave. So first things first, just standard conventions. I'm just saying that little u, little v are what I use for Eddington coordinates. Big U, big V are null Kruskal coordinates. And if we forget what my conventions are, we can go back to this. And I want to describe, spend a good amount of time on this, describe what is the gravitational shockwave on a static black hole as originally derived by Drayen et Hooft and then studied in a separate paper by Matzner. So the idea is this. You could consider either a shockwave on the future horizon or on the past horizon. I'm following the old literature by considering it as a response to a delta function source. So on the future horizon, the stress tensor is TUU proportional to a delta function in U. So I've denoted that on this diagram by the green zigzag line. And to understand the effect of the shockwave on the future horizon, you can send ingoing test particles across it. And what happens in the most extreme case is that if you consider an ingoing test particle along the past horizon, when it crosses the shockwave, it will shift. And there are two effects associated with this shift. The one that's easy to draw on the diagram is that as a result of crossing the shockwave, the ingoing light ray that was on the past horizon will in fact eventually hit this space-like singularity. That's number one. And number two, I am considering a shockwave that is a localized shockwave. It's not a shell, it depends on the angle. So the amount of the shift depends on the points on the bifurcation surface that the particles hit. And this you can think of as a refraction effect in a way that I'll make precise later on. But this diagram following the blue line essentially captures what is the effect of the shockwave, and the shockwave is the zigzag green line. And I just want to point out that if you look at these two papers, these classic references, they have slightly different diagrams describing the same geometry. And I just wanted to point out that either if you want to think of in the vein of a scattering problem, you plot the axes for the original background, the black hole, you draw a shockwave in green and then see the effect of test light rays crossing it, they get shifted, or you can emphasize the fact that the black hole plus shockwave is an exact solution, and you can plot the exact solution as the background. Underneath this blue line, I didn't make an attempt to draw it, but there is a black line underneath the blue line. So without the test particle, you have a broken set of Kruskal axes. And in this picture, the test light ray continues to move along straight lines. So either way, the essential physics is that it will hit the singularity. And as I said, if you want, you can consider putting a shockwave on the past horizon. And I only draw this diagram to for those of you who have heard of the literature on traversable wormholes, this is what they're talking about. For any reasonable matter distribution, the shift will go this way. And so the goal was to engineer a wrong sign shift so that when you send a signal from this universe, you'd like it to propagate into this universe. But for reasonable matter distributions, this does not happen. So I just wanted to illustrate that so you can see both diagrams. Same thing here. So the goal is generalize that picture to rotating backgrounds. My main focus was on Kerr, but it's trivial to add the charge, so I just did the calculation for Kerr-Newman, and so you will see formulas for Kerr-Newman, but I will probably just slip into saying Kerr because that's what I actually care about. So this is the goal. So I want to spend a good amount of time now, as I said, talking about the Newman-Penrose formalism. As far as I understand, before the early 60s, when you wrote down a tetrad formalism of GR, you had in mind the frame of a local observer, so you would align the frame fields with a set of local time-like coordinates. You'd have a time direction, you'd have three spatial directions. And there was a lot in the original Newman-Penrose paper, but their essential foundational point was that often we care about the light cone structure, so why not align the local frame with the local light cones? And so there are two parts to this. The physically clear part is to think of, by convention, L as being tangent to outgoing curves, L prime as being tangent to ingoing curves, and you can go to a complex variables in the transverse plane if you want to, which is in effect thinking of, instead of d theta and d phi separately, think of combinations like d theta plus I sine theta d phi. And from my point of view, I retained this off-diagonal signature in the transverse space because the whole name of the game is to take compact but unwieldy tensor formulas and decompose them into tractable bite-sized scalar formulas. So I would prefer to think of real equations in pairs and group them into complex numbers. And that's what the off-diagonal tangent space metric in the transverse space does. So these are the conditions. I just want to point out this useful set of transformations. M prime is defined to be the ordinary complex conjugate of M. It's just convenient to introduce a prime notation for this reason, that the exchange of primed and unprimed quantities is a useful way to sort of effectively cut down the number of things you have to memorize by half. And this third operation, the Sachs operation, is sort of an analog of Hodge duality. It's a way of flipping spatial and temporal directions while taking into account the associated signs. So the notation will be manifestly covariant under conjugation and priming, but not under Sachs because it does not commute with ordinary complex conjugation. And part of the issue I had when learning this formalism from the classic references is that, for example, if you look at spinners in spacetime, they do a very thorough job of developing the formalism, but it's very short on explicit examples. When you look in Chandrasekhar's book, it is very thorough on detailed examples, but it uses the original formalism, not the GHP formalism, which I'll explain shortly. So if anything, part of the purpose of this talk is to provide you with a new, non-trivial, working example of how to use the formalism. So every time I introduce formalism, I will show you what it looks like in the Kerr-Newman background. So this is the, these are the tetrad 1 forms in standard TR theta phi coordinates. These are the associated vectors that define the inverse metric. And I use this notation. Delta is the thing for which when it goes to 0, you have horizons. So we call it the horizon function. And capital R is just a convenient combination of R and a cosine theta, complex number. So first things first, what is the GHP formalism? Well, the GHP formalism is the following thing. That, as you know, if you want to describe a classical field theory of the metric tensor in terms of a tetrad formalism, you necessarily introduce with it a local ambiguity under transforming the frame, local rotations of the frame. A subgroup of this is what I'm going to organize the formalism by, and this is the GHP formalism, where you, as I said earlier, you fix by convention that L is tangent to outgoing rays, L prime is tangent to ingoing rays, but because everything is null, you have a residual ambiguity that's in a boost and an inverse boost and a rotation of the transverse plane, and it's convenient to organize that in terms of a complex number lambda. So this collection of rules, and these are local, so lambda is a function of x, this set of transformations is what I will call the GHP group, and objects that transform in a covariant way with respect to it are said to be weighted objects, and this is the notation that I use standard in representation theory in particle physics. Now, where there is a gauge invariance, there is an associated gauge field because you would like to write down derivatives that are covariant under the gauge transformation. And the spin connection is the gauge field for local SO3-1 transformations, and the convention is to contract the base space index with a frame field and define a collection of scalar fields in spacetime called the spin coefficients. And if you assume the torsion-free condition, you can solve for the spin coefficients in terms of the frame. And so, as you know, when you take a larger group and break it down to a smaller group, the gauge field of the larger group breaks up into a bunch of things, some of which transform as gauge fields of the smaller group, and the rest of which transform in other ways. So in this case, some of the components of the spin connection will transform as weighted objects or as matter fields, and the rest will be gauge fields for the GHP group. And in some sense, a lot of this is just a notation dump, but it's necessary. So this is the standard notation for directional derivatives along L and M. These two combinations of spin coefficients are the required gauge fields to fix or to make D covariant under the GHP transformation. And the standard notation for this from the GHP paper is that the modified version of D, which is the directional derivative along L, that transforms in as a covariantly under the GHP group is called Thorn and is denoted by this symbol. And the Hodge dual version of it is denoted F, this symbol here. And so it is convenient to organize things in terms of these properly weighted covariant derivative objects. And again, I'm taking a collection of things and organizing them into comprehensible bite-sized chunks. So there are names given to each component of the spin connection. I will explain what the physics is that assigns these names, but you know, when I write down kappa, I mean gamma 3-1-1 and so forth. And by priming, you can obtain the other ones. So priming this thing gives you gamma 4-2-2, which I denote by kappa prime and so forth. And in this language, you will find that this GHP invariant combination of spin connection components is proportional to the delta that I showed you earlier. So that's how you see horizons in this formalism. The Hodge dual is the poles and spherical coordinates. And then for Kerr, we also have a stationary limit surface. So you can go to the standard references to find the standard physical interpretation of these things. But I found that if I'm going to commit to a tetrad formalism that is based on the concept of differential forms, that I would like to develop an understanding of what these things mean directly from the Cartan equations. And so just expanding this out in the Newman-Penrose notation gives you these things. And the question is, what is the physical meaning of the D of a one form? And you know, there are many ways to explain this, but the way I think about it is that one forms are made to be integrated against. So take a one form, integrate it on a curve, then deform the curve. The antisymmetric derivative will pop out, and that is the meaning of the exterior derivative. So as one does, you when you analogous to taking the action for a point particle in GR and extremizing it, you can take the integral of each one form, LL prime, MM prime, impose an action principle, and then just obtain a bunch of dynamical equations in terms of the deformation of the curve, which is this black triangle thing. And this leads to the same interpretation as in the standard tensor formalism, when you decompose the tensorial gradient of, let's say, L or L prime. So here, I'm not going to go through each one in too much detail, but here, for example, you will find that the left-hand side is, in an unfamiliar notation, the same as the left-hand side of the geodesic equation. So when you turn off kappa, you get exactly the geodesic equation. And when you turn on kappa, you can think of it mathematically as some kind of force, like a right-hand side of the geodesic equation. So we think of it as parametrizing the bending of light rays, and so we call it a refraction. Similarly here, I use the complex notation z just to show you, if you focus on this part of the equation, this part we said is GHP covariantly constant for geodesics, so set it to zero for the moment. And this is intended to make you think of complex analysis, that when you have a holomorphic transformation, it parametrizes a dilation and a rotation, which are called expansion and twist in this language. And any map from the plane to itself that preserves area but is not a rotation is called shear, and that manifests as an anti-holomorphic transformation. This thing, I put it here because I made a valiant attempt in my paper to interpret it, but ultimately, I'm not so happy with the interpretation of tau. The standard terminology is angular velocity. I will stick to it, but if anybody wants to talk about it later, I'm here all week. And so again, working example, you compute these things for the tetrad I gave you at the beginning, you will find that the outgoing and ingoing light rays are chosen to be shear-free geodesics. The difference between the rotating black hole and the non-rotating black hole is whether there is an imaginary part to rho and rho prime, whether there is twist. And the time-like analog of the twist is the non-zero value of these angular velocity parameters. So again, this is just using Kerr as a working example for the GHP formalism. And there's physics of test light rays or physics of null congruences encoded in the weighted spin coefficients. There is also physics encoded in the gauge fields. The physics of the gauge fields is that they encode the properties of the background, the black hole itself. And I did not write an explicit formula here getting this from this because I could only figure it out in a sort of ad hoc way, and this is another thing that somebody who knows this stuff better than me should talk to me about it. But anyway, you can extract the surface gravity from the non-affinity of the light rays, and you can extract the angular velocity of the black hole from the Hodge dual of that. And only now do we get to curvature. So I spent a lot of time on the spin coefficients because there is a lot of physics contained in the spin connection, and that was included, you know, the title of the original Newman-Penrose paper involved the words, a method of spin coefficients. So the point was to emphasize that there is physics there. But ultimately, we need to get to curvature. And there is a great paper from the 60s that explains the physics contained in each component of the Weyl tensor. So as we know, Kerr is a vacuum solution. So all of its real physics is contained in the Weyl tensor. And you can ask the question, under local SO3-1 transformations, how many components of the Weyl tensor can I gauge away simultaneously? And classifying spacetimes based on that answer is equivalent to the standard Petrov classification. So all of the black holes that we care about have this component zero, non-zero, and the rest zero. And so when I say the words gravitational Coulomb field, that's what I mean. It means type D in the Petrov classification. And this is standard notation for the Ricci tensor. I only put this up so that when I write down phis, you will know roughly what I'm talking about. And there isn't too much more to say about that. So just to show you an example of what these things look like in this formalism, this is the ingoing longitudinal wave, and this is the response to a energy momentum source of this form. And this looks kind of opaque and foreign until you recall the properties I listed earlier. The tetrad we have chosen are shear-free null geodesics. This is zero, the whole thing is zero. And you can proceed in this way. So again, zero, 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 zero. And this part here is actually just the Reichardt-Hurry equation in GHP notation. So it tells you about the focusing of geodesics. If you compute these things, you will find zero for the Kerr solution, and that just reflects the fact that it's a vacuum solution. So again, use the tetrad that I gave you, compute the curvature scalars. You will find, so let's set Q to zero for a minute, just so we're talking about Kerr. The entirety of the curvature is encapsulated in this number. And if you turn on charge, you find you also need a response to, it's an electro vacuum solution, not just a vacuum solution, so you need a Maxwell field to support it. And That's what this tells you. So now that we've spent time thinking about formalism, we go back to the original Dre et Hooft paper, and we recognize that the metric, in fact, takes this form. Schwarzschild background plus a scalar times the outer product of two null directions. And for a general metric, so for flat spacetime here, this form was called the Kerr-Shield metric. And in the 80s, Taub studied a more general version, which is you take an arbitrary metric here and consider a shift of this form and compute the spin connection and the curvature and see where S appears in the resulting expressions. And so the Dre et Hooft metric is of this form, and so this invites us to study the properties of Kerr-Shield metrics more generally. And right, so my ansatz was, you know, follow your nose, replace Schwarzschild with Kerr. You know what L and what L is for Kerr. This factor comes from just the choice of normalization of L prime relative to L. This is the same with an appropriate definition of U and V. Alpha is the surface gravity for Kerr. And I posit this profile where the only difference is now you know that you have to subtract off the angular velocity of the horizon. So you have this modified angular coordinate. And ultimately, that's it. It's done. You do the thing. You plug it in. You find that it works. But why does it work? Why should it work? And for that, we can study the generalized Kerr-Shield form. Yeah?
So you do that, and you calculate some energy momentum tensor that will solve that, some equations for that.
No, you do that and first compute the curvature.
Okay.
And then, you know, in general, you can posit any metric you want, compute the curvature, say, you know, I'm done. But the question is, does the right-hand side have a physical interpretation? So if we go back to here, the right-hand side from this metric is TUU proportional to delta of U, delta function to some fixed theta and phi. And so it's important that, in fact, the nonlinearities in S drop out. Otherwise, you won't have a solution. You need to match a delta function with a delta function. And so I was proceeding by ansatz, compute curvature, show that it's linear, and then you know you can posit the same right-hand side.
Can I ask, your shock it
yep.
carried energy in
yes.
the black hole onto the mass? Yes.
I mean, the way it was formulated in the Verlinde paper. If you throw in a particle, you do this, you modify the location of the event horizon. The way I've done it now is just the basic thing where you take the energy momentum tensor is TUU, and you plop that thing on the out, on the future horizon. And that's the full geometry.
Okay.
So I'm not throwing anything in.
But is it fair to say that the mass was one value in the past? In one half of the diagram.
Yeah, it's a little bit. That's why I said that the way that I understand the physical effect is by just seeing what happens to test light rays as they cross it. It's not clear to me, for example, you know, if the bifurcation surface is now well defined and you can associate a surface gravity with the thing because there's a shift in these
yeah.
coordinates. So. You know, people keep saying to me, "What you know, try to do a coordinate transformation to remove the discontinuity and see what the resulting geometry is." I don't know what it means because the whole point of this method is that you know, it's the original Penrose method of you take two known solutions, glue them together, and try to figure out what the junction conditions are. If you try to remove the singularity, you'll end up with like non-Schwarzschild on both sides, and I don't really know how to interpret it. So the short answer to your question is I don't know more than I've said. I don't know in what sense to think of this thing as like, it's still like a well-defined black hole with you know, a bifurcation surface. It's a black hole with a shockwave on the outer horizon, that's it.
Okay, so I'm not sure I'm gonna get an answer to this
okay,
question,
yeah.
but I'll try it.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope that the shockwave carried energy in.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it carry angular momentum as well?
Yes, because it's a delta function in angle.
Can I tune those two parameters? Like, can I increase the amount of energy and change the amount of angular momentum? Like, if I look at the parameters
mm-hmm.
here. Obvious.
Well.
Like the amplitude of F.
Yeah. So. if you go back to, all the way back to this diagram, right? The amplitude of the particle that you put here is what generates the shift.
Yeah.
And the explicit form of f, the whole point of the result is that it turns into a Green's function for some operator.
Okay.
And then we can see all of the physical parameters appearing in that operator, and then we can see whether we can mess with those. But yeah, other than that, I don't really know.
Can I ask you another question?
Yep.
If I have the care metric, I could have written it as flat phase.
Indeed.
L. It, or is it L? I was wondering, is the L in your expression the same one that would have appeared in the care shield?
So if I remember correctly, I think no.
It's not.
I think no. But the coordinates for the original Kerr-Shield form are these funny Cartesian coordinates, and
but yeah. L is a vector, so it doesn't really.
If I remember correctly, it's supposed. So when I think of L, I'm thinking about it as the untilded form, so the associated with untilded without the tilde,
yeah,
so associated with the
yeah.
background. So the original one is supposed to be a principal null direction now that you say that, right, because it's about flat space. You know what, short answer, I don't know, but we could try to figure that out. I don't remember. Yeah. Because I was going to say what you do is if you do try to do two perturbations, you look at the principal null directions of the original, but the original is flat space time, so yeah, fair question, I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I see why. Yeah, anyway, okay. Righto. So so now that you have the diagram fresh in your mind, remember I said in the beginning there are two effects associated with the shift. There is the actual shift in U, and there is the refraction effect. If you look in general for this kind of shift, so shift L prime with respect to the original L times a scalar function, you can compute the associated spin coefficients. And in my paper, I did not assume shear free geodesics to write these formulas down, but once you specialize to shear free geodesics, which is the case we care about, you find indeed, I interpreted kappa prime as a refraction effect associated with the ingoing null rays, and you find a refraction effect associated with the ingoing null rays. And I interpreted the presence of horizons, and in this talk I'm only talking about apparent horizons, so I'm defining them by the vanishing of the expansion of null congruences. So when you shift this thing, you basically get a shifted V. And that's how it appears in this formalism. Correspondingly, you get a shifted L prime, but really its more covariant version is Thorn prime, and this is the expression you get. And at this stage, no approximation has been made. I just assumed background properties, but I did not assume anything about the size of S. And so the final thing is this, that if you assume, so remember this was the conjugate to T mu, L nu, and this is the primed version. If you assume that there is no, let's say, TVV, then in fact, the curvature, when you can just explicitly compute all of the curvature scalars, you find that they are linear in S, and no approximation has been made. It's just a true statement in general for any S. And that's essentially why this works. It's special properties of null perturbations that makes it exact. So here's an explicit expression, probably means very little, but there it is. And then the fun starts and you compute. And in addition, in the original papers they showed you, because they were concerned about solving Einstein's equation, they showed you RUU, but they did not, as far as I can tell, compute the Weyl tensor. So an output of this formalism is you get everything. So In addition to the response from the local source of energy momentum, you also get in the gravitational compass interpretation an outgoing transverse wave. And so I'm just writing this down to say, well, you can try to, the name of the game here is organizing the calculation instead of just proceeding blindly. So you can say, well, you know what the weight is under GHP transformations. You know what the weight is of F from the weight of S, and to make the formalism covariant, requiring covariance of this thing induces a transformation law for S. And if you want to try to compute psi 4 as a warm-up, you find, in fact, there aren't too many possible operators there could appear. There's this thing, and there's this thing. So great, fun, compute, you get something. There you go. And that's the warm-up. And the final point is RUU, which is encapsulated by phi 2-2. In the original paper, where you turn off the angular momentum of the background, you basically set all of the taus to zero because they were angular velocities. You get this thing, which you might have expected because it is the only thing you could possibly get. And this thing here encodes the 2D Laplacian. So if you go back to the original paper, you will find that that their Green's function equation was this. Is this visible? And so I wanted to find the explicit form of this thing when you turn on angular momentum. And there it is. So I have not made any attempt to invert that thing and try to expand it in spheroidal harmonics, see what its properties are. In the original paper, you can see an integral form, which is basically just messing with spherical harmonics. The important point is the sign. As I said earlier, you can only get a fixed sign for the shift. You can't have it shift the other way. So I expect the same thing is true here, but I really just haven't tried to study the eigenfunctions of this operator. I was hoping somebody would know it. I showed it to Saul Tucholsky. He was like, nope. So, okay. So this is what I have. And next steps basically are to proceed with quantum field theory, and that's where this talk ends. So thank you. Yeah, so I get the same complaint a lot. I basically said, I'm motivated by real physics, and I'm happy to specialize to it. Honestly, Alexei asked me, for example, if you want to consider the 5D black hole and try to formulate it in this way and so forth, and I haven't really thought about it.
But there were two key ingredients.
Yes.
This is very superficial, but one was the Newman-Penrose,
yes.
The other was the Kerr-Schill.
Yes.
The Kerr-Schill, you get that for free, in any number of dimensions.
Yeah.
You don't think that's enough to... kind of looked like you were shifting the...
Yeah, so let me speculate a little wildly, because I really just have not studied 5D or higher. In general, anytime you have an even number of dimensions, you can always do this 2 plus 2n type decomposition, right? And if the horizons are null surfaces and have the associated u and v, I expect you can do something like this. I would expect with the appropriate formalism, there you probably could adapt this to the black holes you would care about in higher dimensions, but truly, I don't know.
But you really think the
Yeah, I mean, the Kerr-Schill, this is totally general, so.
Yeah, no, but the, you, mm-hmm. you, 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 You're not very enthusiastic about it.
I'm just saying that I don't want to, I just don't know.
You just think that the Penrose-Newman formalism is sort of really to unwrap the physics or the equations.
That's the impression I got, but I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not optimistic, I just have literally no idea. So I don't want to probably say probably yes and then have it be no, I just,
I
don't know.
I'm really impressed. Say it with confidence.
I try to say only what I know with minimal, you know, prodding, but yeah, I really don't know.
I'm sorry. I just have a very, very silly question. So,
yep.
What is this useful? I mean, what I should be using this for if I cannot just, you know, simple-minded guy use Maple, Mathematica, compute whatever, you know.
So
whatever wild tensor, whatever I need. What it does.
So again, but my motivation. Wait, do you mean the method or do you mean the result?
I want to see where you are going. So you presented a method, which is,
yes,
as far as I understand, repackaging of, you know,
yep,
what was before.
Yep.
And I want to understand what does it buy.
So my motivation was pretty just follow my nose. Wise people invented the first example of black hole statistical mechanics based on this reasoning. I wanted to understand how much of this reasoning carries through for realistic black holes. The natural formalism seemed to be Newman-Penrose. I went with it. I indeed reduced the curvature to a Green's function equation on the horizon. And next step is to just proceed, you know, in the way that the literature did, now try to compute out-of-time ordered correlators and so forth. So from a purely gravitational point of view, that's sort of where my story ends. I don't know what you can do with it further. But my motivation was to try to understand what types, so positing that quantum mechanics and quantum field theory are unmodified, try to understand in what sense can a quantum field theory be a black hole. And so this provides a next step other than just matching the thermodynamic equilibrium properties. That's what I used it for.
But I saw this type of arguments about, you know, quantum field theory in the black hole horizon have a classical GR, right? I mean, they are quite robust insofar as you use classical.
No, that's the point, that I'm saying that it's not. I'm saying that classical gravity coupled to quantum matter fields is not reasonable.
So you still have class, you're not planning to quantize anything that you said.
I mean, it's in the spirit of ADS-CFT where you don't directly quantize the bulk, you posit a dual theory and try to show that it has the correct correlation function. So here I'm just saying that there are additional correlation functions you need to consider, which are those that are sensitive to shockwaves, namely, you know, commutator squared and out-of-time ordered correlators.
But that computation was done in a normal formula.
Which one?
I mean Verlinde's.
Yeah, Verlinde's used the known shockwave solution, basically, and redid it in the context of quantum field theory. I just wanted to go back and say, like, does this generalize directly for Kerr? Because I didn't know, and I didn't see it in the literature. That's all.
Since you mentioned it, I just don't know, if I stick to four dimensions,
mm-hmm,
can I turn on a cosmological content?
Yes.
And I get that for free?
So that's the thing that I was working on but had to put on hold because I have to speak. So where is that? So I'm here. Joe and Nick and I have been doing this. In fact, we can do it for any type D background, the Plobansky-Demyansky solution.
Okay.
Yep. Yes.
Right. Okay.
And the C metrics and all of those fun things.
Yeah, no. But even if you just have classical background,
mm-hmm,
now, as you were saying, you,
mm-hmm,
can start to fool around in,
mm-hmm,
holography and see what the consequences of your shockwaves are.
Right. So I know that it reduces to a Green's function equation. I have not taken step two to see like what happens when you mess with the cosmological constant, what does the profile look like, and so forth. But yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to do.
I know the rotating black holes in higher dimensions with a negative cosmological constant, they start to look terrible. Well, I guess they already do in the last minute, but But you know, does this care shield form?
Yes.
Survives?
Yes.
In higher dimensions?
Oh, I don't know.
Sorry. Okay.
Again, it's not that I am like down on higher dimensions. I just had to pick something. I have not studied it. Yeah, I don't know.
So does anything interesting happens when this black hole becomes extremal?
Yeah, so the short answer to that question is I don't know, but this is why I don't know. If you go look in a paper from 95 by Svetsos, which a lot of the modern shockwave literature cites, he says, notice that the solution ceases to exist in the extremal limit. Now, I don't quite know what that means, but I can tell you that when you take this thing and find the 2D Laplacian on the squashed sphere, and then just look at the rest and put it into a form similar to this thing, this number, which we typically call the mass term, it is proportional to the surface gravity. So this number is what vanishes in the extremal limit. Svetsos says that that means that the solution ceases to exist. I have no idea what that means. But that's the phenomena. That's the phenomenology of the extremal limit as far as I understand.
What would extremal mean? Usually I have a very symmetric black hole and I want the surface gravity to go to zero, or I want the horizons to be degenerate. So I'm just a...
Yeah, isn't that standard mass equals charge? Or mass equals charge squared plus...
But you have sort of this solution with a shock wave. Mm-hmm. So you must mean that the horizons degenerate in some part of the space.
Yeah, right. I meant the simple-minded, like stupid thing of take the parameters equal and show that the mass term goes to zero. As I said, I don't really know whether there is a well-defined like bifurcation surface, well-defined geometry, what it means to take the extremal limit really, other than just that stupid turning of the parameter crank. So short answer, you know, as I said, Svetsos said one thing. Okay, I don't really know what it means. Yeah, but I mean, part of the point of this, which I didn't really say, is. This approach, which very broadly speaking goes under the Hooft S matrix formalism, it does not assume an expansion around the extremal limit. So I specifically wanted to focus on the generic case. I don't have a good answer to that.
Yeah. Okay, general question is to go to you again.